Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt with Rolling Stone, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. We have with us today a very special guest, Jake Clemons of the E Street Band. What's up, man? How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Yeah, happy to be on the show. Thanks a lot for having me.
Absolutely. Great to have you here. And you have a new solo album out.
Yeah, it's called Fear and Love, and it's my first full-length record, and I'm super excited about it.
Fear and Love. So basically, like, everything.
You know, in my mind anyway, like, it, fear and love are like our most primitive emotions that we can experience, and so there's an aspect of just I don't know, the vulnerability of life, but more specifically, it's an autobiography in a sense of coming out of a hard relationship, like having to recognize what a bad relationship is and recovering from that, and having some own, you know, your own personal recovery for who you are, and then finding a way to embrace what love is supposed to be, you know?
Yeah, it's a very pretty sounding album that is about some painful stuff. It's an interesting combination. You're not yelling and screaming about it for the most part.
No. I wanted to have a really honest approach and be really vulnerable with the record. You know, so I was able to compile it into a side one and side two, and really get into the, you know, I guess my most intimate and sincere feelings on side one, and you know, hoping to express if there was pain, then the way that pain felt and the challenge of reconciling it. But straight into side two, which is breaking free of that and starting a new journey that was going to be open to exploring the beauties of what love has offered for myself and for someone else.
Now, you know, this record is not an hour of you playing saxophone. you sing and play guitar. What came first? The sax, the singing, the playing? How did that work growing up? Like, what was your development?
I often say that music was my first language. You know, we grew up with it in the home very, very heavily. So it's just something that happened. It wasn't until I saw the E Street Band play for the first time when I was 8 years old that that sax was even a thought, you know. And it was only a purely vain moment where I heard the eruption of applause for my beloved uncle that I said to myself, like, oh my God, people really love the saxophone, and decided that that's what I wanted to do. And my dad was wise enough and dad enough to say, you can play the saxophone after you play the piano. So that was my first instrument, and that's where I started, and everything else was born from that. It was a great beginning because it's a perfect introduction to what music is.
So you see a saxophone on a stage in an arena. Where was this show?
North Carolina.
In North Carolina, which is where you grew up,
the
right?
Tunnel of Love tour. We lived there briefly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tunnel of Love tour. So you see the effect a saxophone can have in an E Street Band show in an arena. You're 8 years old?
That's right.
Yeah. And then you work and then you go back to the basics of music, work from piano, and work for years, and then end up on stage with the E Street Band playing the saxophone. That's got to be one of the craziest stories in all of music.
it's a strange story, you know, and it's one that I never anticipated or desired necessarily. Yeah. You know, I was very, very happy and content, you know, like just making my own discoveries, and you know, piano, like I said, was a great foundation to understand the fundamentals of music. It led me into saxophone, as I eventually allowed to play, but having a wind instrument, you know, at my fingertips, and a piano led into other things like guitar and drums and whatever else. So, you know, this language that I grew up speaking as a young child, I was then able to be more articulate with different instruments. Going into songwriting was like a great tool, you know?
Yeah. So where did you grow up mostly?
My dad was in the Marine Corps, so I was born in Beaufort, South Carolina, which is where Parris Island is, which is the Marine Corps boot camp on the East Coast. And we, you know, after a short stint there, moved to Hawaii, and we were there for two tours, if you will. And then North Carolina, then Virginia, then California, then back to Virginia, then Utah, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. How did that affect you moving around like that?
It was great, you know, in terms of like helping me to make friends quickly and live in the moment and appreciate, you know, what I have in the moment, and then to be able to move away from the moment, you know, I guess, became a simple thing as well. You know, it's when you're living in one place for a short time, you make friends and it's great, but then it's time to go. So it was a great setup for tour life, I should say.
That makes sense. Yeah, you ended up recreating that existence. But was your father musical at all?
My dad was a band director for the Marine Corps band.
Oh, okay.
And very celebrated for that as well. You know, it's funny because, like, Clarence Clemens Day is something that was initiated a few years ago on his birthday, right? So it's Clarence Clemens Day is January 11th. It never hit me quite so hard until the last couple of years to realize that in Hawaii, there's a day named after my father.
Wow.
You know, that was 30 years ago because of what he had, you know, given to the community as a band director. Really significant. But that's crazy, you know, like as a living person to have that happen.
Yeah. But basically, there's a lot of musical talent just in your family. Like, it's pretty widespread, I guess.
Yeah, when they can finally pinpoint that in the genes, I would imagine that it's pretty thick in the blood there.
When and how did you become aware of, assuming before that show, of your uncle's kind of fame and talent and place in the musical world?
That took a long time, to be honest with you, you know? Clarence was, you know, he's my uncle, and that's just what I knew.
Right.
So, and the rest of the band, you know, like they were his family too, you know, so then they were my family. So, it seemed normal to hear people that you knew on the radio. I figured that, you know, as a kid, you don't really question those things. It's just what you know.
Right.
So it took a long time for that to kind of sink in, I guess, you know, like, you know, someone's dad is special because they're a cop.
Yeah.
You know, like when you're 10 years old, it's like, oh man, their dad is a police officer or a firefighter, you know? It was the same kind of sense for me. It took a long time for me to really understand the depths and significance of what it meant, not just for a community of music lovers, but like for culture as a whole.
So what were you up to for most of like your 20s?
Oh man, all kinds of things. I toured for a bit. I did television for a bit. I did like advertising for a bit, and
music for advertising, or like you worked in advertising.
Like I worked in advertising. I was a creative director of new business for an advertising firm.
Huh.
And then I got like my insurance license and did estate planning for a bit. And I've had a really strange. I don't know. I'm a very curious person.
Yeah.
And want to, you know, I often want to see what I'm capable of, if you will. I don't know. There's a lot of things around that. Music's what's always been natural to me. I love being on tour, but it's also a thing that scared me because I watched, beyond the glorious things that it gave Clarence, I watched, and so, you know, I was able to see some of the not so glorious things as well, you know, the series of heartbreaks and struggle with, you know, relationships, you know, and like what it can do to an immediate family, you know, a nucleus. And, that intimidated me. I had to reconcile that. And that's actually a big part of reconciling that fears is a big part of what's on this record even.
So just the thing of, you know, you try to be a family man, but your job involves, you know, possibly going to Australia for a month and then six months, that kind of thing, basically. That and the pull of the a very different lifestyle.
Yeah, you know, like nobody wants to have failures behind them, you know. So, you know, I was afraid of that, you know. Like life is what it is, you know. And I guess that's what I had to finally just embrace and just say that, like, I'm going to be okay with, like, recognizing what is my, like, rightfully my fear and then reconciling that, but also recognizing what is not rightfully my fear, you know, like the things that that affected my uncle's life don't necessarily need to affect my life in the same way, you know.
Right.
Like, those aren't mine, you know. We can celebrate the wins and recognize the losses, but you know, at the end of the day, like anything else, like you've got to stand on your own two feet and recognize that like you're not, you might be standing in someone else's footprints, but you're not standing in anyone else's shoes.
Right. So you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm here with Jake Clemons, and we'll be right back with more.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
So we were talking about Clarence, and you know, you mentioned he had some pitfalls in his lifestyle. He was, I mean, he pretty famously like was a hard partier. He lived a big life. He had a lot of different women coming in his life, and that's I guess what you're talking about.
Well, you know, I don't want to be critical of him in his own essence.
Yeah.
I just knew that it's not something that I wanted for myself, you know, and. All that being said, he was a man with an enormous amount of love, like an ability to love, and this incredible nature to help other people understand that they were indeed understood. You know, like his music even conveyed that, and it was an enormous gift. And there's a quote that my girlfriend's father actually introduced me to that says, like, your greatest strengths are... it's like the adverse of your differences, of your faults.
Right.
You know, so like you can't have it all, you know, like you're going to, it's great. If you're the greatest, then you're also going to be the worst, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's all people don't necessarily have like close relationships with their uncle. You know, it's like some people, you know, they're there. You see them when you see them. In your case, like how close were you? What was your relationship like? How did it develop? Like,
Well, you know, like my dad was in the Marine Corps and, you know, very strict Southern Baptist background. I don't know. I think because of the nature of who I am as an individual, we had a lot of differences, you know? I was not one that could ever be in a marching band. You know, that's just not something that it would just grind against like who I am as a person.
Right.
That being said, you know, like Clarence and I felt like he understood me, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I did not feel that from my dad. You know, so it was a really significant relationship in that way, you know. Like Clarence was invaluable to my existence. And knowing that there was a man who understood me and cared about me and would also help to guide my experience very passively, you know.
How so?
Well, by asking questions and listening.
Yeah. How aware was he of your music making and also like the sax specifically? When did you get serious about the sax?
I was serious from the sax.
Okay.
Like from the get-go. Like,
but you were doing piano first.
Before I was able to play saxophone, I was serious about the saxophone.
Gotcha, okay.
Yes, you know, so he was you know, a big asset in that realm as well. He gifted me my first saxophone, and I had a great beginning of my professional career at a young age because of that. Being able to, spend a lot of time practicing because I had one at home. And as a songwriter, I was very shy and like nervous as a songwriter. So it took me a long time to let anyone, especially whose opinion I appreciated, be exposed to my songwriting. I think it was probably, 2005 maybe, the first time I let him hear a song that I'd, you know, had written. And then the next time would have been like 2007, probably. You know, it wasn't something that I put out there a lot. But his response to it all was incredibly encouraging. He was really kind in offering in his own interviews. You know, people are talking to him about being Clarence Clemons, and his response. I was in the room with him, and he says, "You know, you should actually be talking to my nephew. He's a great songwriter, and he's putting together some great things." So humbling to hear my uncle say that.
So were you out on the road with him sometimes as a kid?
In my 20s, a lot.
Yeah.
A lot. Yeah. Yeah. I was on the road with him a lot.
So just, and like, what would you like do all day? Like, what was your kind of role? Just hanging out?
Yeah. You know, like he would ask me to come on tour. Yeah. You know, like he maybe like wasn't feeling great, or, we just appreciated each other's company. And, I don't know. The love that I've had for him has been tremendous. So like to the point where like, I don't know, I just wanted to help and be there and whatever he needed, you know, like I was happy to, to be some sense of moral support. And, you know, we had like a brotherhood beyond like a father son relationship.
Yeah.
We understood each other, and it was a great gift.
The songs you were first writing, were they in roughly the style that you're writing in now, or how, and what kind of, who were your influences as a songwriter?
Because of my upbringing with music, growing up in a really strict household where I wasn't allowed to listen to rock and roll at an early age.
Oh, it was that strict?
That was the devil's music. We were allowed to listen to, gospel and marching band music, John Philip Sousa, you know, like, classical music. You know, that's what we had in the house. When I started listening to rock and roll, it wasn't a natural thing. I had a kind of acquire taste for rock music, and then that spilled into a lot of other different genres. And, I've listened, if you look at my playlist, they cover the gambit, you know? I would hope that they all influence my songwriting in some way. I don't tend to write in one genre. I release music as it fits, an appropriate theme or whatever, but my writing can go from, I don't know, house music to bluegrass, you know?
Yeah, there's some kind of, there's at least one strongly country flavored song on the record.
Yeah.
What was that one called though?
Sick, Broke, and Broken.
Yeah, I really dug that one. Stood out. Yeah. Do you listen to a lot of like hardcore country, or is it just more kind of osmosis?
I would say it's osmosis. I'm constantly listening to different things. That track actually, I considered putting a gospel choir on it. You know, there's a sense of my roots in that that Southern gospel.
Yeah,
that was almost portrayed through that song. I decided not to, just to serve the record as best as I could, but.
So event, I mean, the tour that I know you were on before you were like actually in the band was I think you were around for the Working on a Dream tour.
That's right.
In 2009.
Yeah.
And so was that the first time you'd been out with him, or you'd been around before?
I've been around before.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, there was, I think at the time, like Clarence, I think was definitely like struggling like a little bit, like was physically uncomfortable sometimes on stage, and I think fans kind of thought that maybe you were there as an understudy. Was there any truth to that?
Yeah. Clarence called me before the Magic tour and told me he wasn't feeling well and wanted me to be around because of that. Now, that being said, I basically wouldn't receive that notion of it. You know,
right.
It was like, you're being ridiculous. Of course you're going to be here forever. I'm happy to be here as moral support, and you know, I'm happy to be here as you need me, but like, you know, the idea that I might have to fill in was like not in my reference at all. Like, it was not in my mental capacity.
Right. I mean, it sounded like almost like he was just afraid of having a really bad day, and what would he do, and he wouldn't want the show to have to be canceled, and like, hey, I got, like, I could bring my, was that, do you think that was that just, it was sort of a, like a security valve kind of thing? Yeah.
I don't know. I know that he was in a tremendous amount of pain for a long time and discomfort, and, he had a legitimate concern that, you know, despite his vulnerability with me about it, I didn't receive it as legitimate at the time. I knew he was hurting, but I didn't understand that, like, there's a possibility that we might lose him.
Watching shows on that tour, like, you know, I mean, he was sitting down for parts of the show. I mean, you could see and you could feel it. I think fans were like rooting for him, that it was just, you know, it was tough. Everything was an effort. What was it like? And he, you know, and then it ended up being heroic every time that he came through, you know. Yeah. It was tough, and I can't imagine, what was it like for you to kind of witness that?
It was hard, man. You know, yeah. Even then it was hard because I knew what he was putting himself through. It was hard to watch, you know, like it's what he lived for, but it cost him, you know, like it cost him a lot of pain. It cost him a lot of joy and a lot of pain, you know.
But he obviously had an ethos of just like, I will put myself together and get myself on
without
stage.
Question.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had seen him disassembled and then reassembled on many occasions, you know.
Like Darth Vader. It's like,
almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, yeah. He had 3 hip replacements.
Yeah.
You know, like you have 2 hips.
Right.
He had to have one of his hip replacements replaced.
Right.
You know, yeah. 2 knee replacements, a pacemaker. His back fused, you know, like that. There was this, I used to jokingly call him the $6 billion man, you know, considering inflation. but it was still infinite, you know, like you would always just put the pieces back together again, you know? I can remember like being by his bedside in the hospital and people would come in and think that he was like, is he going to come out of the hospital knowing that, come on, this is we've done this before, you know?
Right.
He bounces back. That's right. What he does. He wants to be on that stage more than anything, and he'll do anything to make sure he's there.
So on some level, I guess you sort of felt like maybe he was invincible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And did you go so far as to learn some songs at that point in case he really did make you step in?
No.
So you weren't. No.
I sincerely did not believe that it would be a possibility for him not to be there.
And is that even something he discussed with, was that like sort of his own private idea that he never, do you think he discussed that with Bruce at the
Apparently
time?
Apparently not.
that's from, yeah, it doesn't seem
I
like
didn't
it, right?
Know, I didn't, yeah. I, you know, I wouldn't, I wasn't one to like, you know, ask him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, because again, like to me, it wasn't even like a logical thought, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and there's a memoir that has been released recently that,
yes.
Where you can clearly understand that it was not something that it was discussed before that.
Yeah, there did seem to be a disconnect there. That's what I thought. Yeah, I mean, that you can understand how in his mind he's like, I'm going to work this. It was his thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah. But that's, you know, yeah. Clarence.
Yeah.
Was Clarence Clement? You know, like,
yeah.
That. The world that existed around him was beautiful and amazing and. Simple in the most complex ways.
Yeah.
And it was a reality that you would not find anywhere else. You know, it is an alternate universe almost.
Yeah, he kind of bent the world to his will, it seems like.
That seems like a really strong way to put it. Yeah. But I mean, like he existed in his own realm.
And who did you get to know the band at that point, or were you kind of just in Clarence world?
I was in Clarence world.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, like, I was very familiar with the band. I grew up calling them, you know, Uncle Steve and Uncle Bruce. And, you know, I was actually in grade school with Gary's niece, which is super bizarre. But, yeah, you know, so it was still family, but, you know, how well do you know your second cousins? You know,
right, it's
one of those things.
I wanted to jump back to the album for a second. Tell you know, we have the great advantage of here in this audio medium of hearing music. What is your? And it's always a tough one, but what is your favorite song on the record? And we can play a little bit of it.
Oh man, come on, that's an impossible question.
All right,
this is Sophie's choice here, man.
What song at this moment would you like to play for a little bit of? For it could be the one you hate the most at the moment. But,
You know, why not play the title track? You know, that's one that sums up the crux.
By the way, what's your name? I can see from your eyes that you're full of regret. We should have said our goodbyes the first day that we met.
By the way. we should have said our goodbyes the first day we met is kind of rough. That's
yeah, you know, I wanted to be as honest and vulnerable with this record as I could, and you know, for me, it's just a matter of like having to recognize the faults of your capacity in the moment, you know, the faults of your capacity to love yourself and to love people around you. And yeah, it's just a very honest element.
Who do you want to sing like? Like, who are your heroes as a vocalist?
You know, I asked myself that question for a long time. I kind of stopped asking myself that altogether, because at the end of the day, like, the greatest vocalists are the ones that you hear and recognize immediately, you know, right? Trying to find your voice for me was not like a natural instinctive thing. I was afraid to sing for a long time. And it wasn't until I was like 30 that I was as adventurous enough to like sing in front of people.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean,
I think you're a very unaffected and direct vocalist, actually, which I think is, and it's for a, you know, obviously you're super old, but I was gonna say, but for a first album, there's a certain like assuredness, and maybe the fact that you're not 19 helps, but it, yeah, you know, there is a certain assuredness and comfort, and like sort of, like I said, lack of, not because there's a tendency for people on in their early work to try too hard, mm-hmm, you know, especially vocally, and you don't have that. It's interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, that this is my best attempt to just be me and to be vulnerable. And I definitely, I absolutely know what you're saying in terms of people like trying and you know, you can recognize their the people that they love to hear sing and the influence of that. Yeah, at this point in my life, I was fortunate enough to be beyond that and just try to be honest.
So were you like on tour when you were writing these songs?
Yeah, I mean, I write all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, I'm going to walk away from today and probably write something, you know.
What is the tip? If you were on the road, when and where would you be writing?
It's spontaneous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like in a hotel room with a, do you demo,
yeah,
set
up a
garage band or like,
yeah. I set up a little studio in the hotel, you know, as I travel. But I also, I mean, there's been songs that I've written as I'm walking down the street and, you know, just put my phone to my face and sing into it.
Right. Very common. Yes. Yeah.
It's a cool experience, because like from that you have to go back and learn the song.
Right.
You have to like learn how to play that.
The playing, you know, being immersed in the Springsteen world, how does that, it must both inevitably influence your songwriting and also kind of pose something that you don't want to try to live up to or think about too much, because you're talking about like one of the great songwriters of, you know, of the century,
yeah,
two centuries maybe. And you know, you're doing your thing. You don't want to kind of being like, I have to live up to, you know, Jungle Land in my first record. So how do you kind of balance all that in your head?
Well, I guess in that context, I thank God for, you know, the fact that Greetings from Asbury Park did not receive critical acclaim off,
sure,
the bat, and The Wild and Innocent, you know, like it took, yeah, a while, yeah, for those to be embraced by the greater masses, and that takes a lot of pressure off of young songwriters, I think, you know.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, I mean, like there's certainly a sense of I don't know, the osmosis, you know, that happens where you're learning and growing as an artist. You know, having just toured the River record, you know, playing the record every night in its entirety, I think is really helped me to understand an even different level of what a story is and becomes. I had finished my record before that tour started, but it helped me to listen to my record differently, and I think it'll probably affect the way that I approach the next record.
Yeah, makes sense. Have you played this record for Bruce?
No, I very shyly handed it, or maybe like even like left it on the table. you know, because it's like
slipped it under the
door. I wanted to have it, but like at the same time, I don't. I'm happy to hear if he loves it, but I don't need to hear that necessarily either. You know,
but you didn't make it for him.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. I think living under the fear of whether or not people are going to embrace it, is going to affect your ability to create. And, maybe he'll listen to it. Maybe he won't, but it is what it is. You know,
how long has he had it now? No, I'm just kidding.
That's a good point. Actually, he has not told me that he loves it.
check your phone. Maybe the email's in there, but, but I think, I mean, it doesn't feel like a debut. It feels like you're a little deeper in. And again, I think it's because you're an experienced musician, maybe, you know?
Well, you know, I released an EP a few years ago that was intended to be a full length. And that was an experience in itself. You know, this is a very different sound and experience from that. But, you know, like I think just the process of being around other songwriters and being a musician that's facilitating a certain role and being able to observe, I would hope it's like greatly affected and influenced what I was able to bring to the table with this record.
I want to pick up the narrative we were on. The last show of Work on Dream Tour was in Buffalo, and I happened to be there. I actually I think I interviewed Bruce there that night for our end of decade issue, and it was a great show. It was also like, I guess there was one other show, but it was the last kind of tour show with Clarence. So I mean, did you feel anything that night? Did any memories? Were you any sense that any foreboding, anything, or
no.
Just yeah,
no,
just
no.
Another show.
Yeah, I mean, if you're an E Street fan, then the question of will this be the last tour has probably been there since 1999.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Since that Blood Brothers reunion tour happened, you know, like, will this happen again? It's probably been a question for a long time. So that sense is probably always been looming, but...
It's so fun. I can't do the mental leap to think of you as... but yes, you were that too. You were a fan, among many other things. You were,
sure.
You know, a friend and relative to the band, but also a fan, yeah. So that again makes this whole narrative all the more crazy, I guess. So then, I mean, you know, to leap ahead, and how many people have asked you about the account in Bruce's memoir so far?
Everyone.
Yeah. So do you want to ask?
The moment I read that, I knew I was never getting away from that one.
It's gonna live forever. Did he warn you in advance about the?
I got a note the day he sent me the book, saying, hey, there's a funny story in there. I think you'll enjoy it. Honestly, I don't know if he intended it to be received the way that it has been. Just given the context of the conversation that we had, you know, I think that,
I think people are probably, if people are people, I don't think people should take it too seriously. I mean, as far as like,
some people take it seriously.
Yeah.
But, you know, nonetheless, you know, it was an intense moment and an intense day, and beyond like what's written, I'm saying like the realities that were around it, you know, everything leading up to that moment, you know, it was a hot plate, if you will, you know, there's lots of things that were swirling around, and that day for me is epic. I mean, like, I'm biblical proportions, you know, it was one of those days that literally everything goes wrong.
Yeah.
And how do you recover from that? You know, like it's that, you know, the portrait of an underdog story that Bruce wrote in that chapter I lived it in a very real way.
I mean, if I had to psychoanalyze it, but maybe that maybe you had some conflict in you about wanting to do this, and maybe if you didn't like super prepare, maybe that was why, because you weren't sure if you wanted to take on the burden and allow this to, because it's a life-changing thing. It is, to a certain extent, stepping into those shoes. It's a lot going on there, and I could see why maybe you would be conflicted.
Oh, for sure. I mean,
or maybe just fucked up. I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, that's a keen observation, but you also have to remember that you're reading it from the context of what Bruce saw, right? So on the other side of it, it is a moment where it was like the 2 weeks, like, you know, during like 2 to 3 weeks, like around Christmas break, right? Between like, I don't know, the middle of December to New Year's, and having not learned anything related to E Street with the intention of like distancing myself as a professional musician.
Right.
To then being asked to delve into learning the fine details of the notes and the intention and carrying the weight of reconciling the loss that I felt, you know, with Clarence, and absolutely questioning whether or not it was even appropriate and how Clarence would feel about it, despite what he'd asked me to do in the past. Yeah, I mean,
it's a lot.
It was a lot. It was a lot. And, you know, contrary to what you read, not that that observation was not accurate on Bruce's behalf, but I was, I spent hours preparing for that day.
Right.
And there was a lot of work that went into it. But on a day like that day.
Yeah.
When, like, there's essentially like a lunar eclipse of my being,
yeah.
You know, like the light was blocked out completely where I, you know, like I you know, the phone goes dead, you know, your directions get confused.
Right.
There's already anxiety.
Well, I will say done interviews at Bruce's house, the GPS, I don't know if the GPS has trouble finding his house. I don't know if you had that, but I
didn't have GPS.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Right, my phone died. So I was, you know, in an unfortunate place at the moment, but, you know, eventually I got there and what transpired, but there's so many ironic things around it that I think were appropriate for what I was being asked to do ultimately. You know, it set the stage in a way that I think is really appropriate. You know, that what we were embarking on was going to require like a complete dismantling of my relationship to the band and the music and, you know, what I was being asked to do leading up to that point, you know.
So, had in your playing before that, because now, I mean, you're probably sick of saying, but while when you improvise, you know, you have your own style, and I can hear it's you, and it's obviously, but when you do play his parts, you sound like him, you know. I mean, you know, you sound like him. Mm-hmm. So, did you recognize a similarity in styles before this, or you did? Okay.
Yeah, there was no getting away from that, and it wasn't intentional. I mean, even in my early career, when I like changed my professional name to distance myself from the legacy that could have potentially been the end of my professional career.
Yeah.
Even then, people would come to me and say, "Wow, man, you really like you sound like Clarence Clemons."
Yeah.
And it wasn't offensive at all.
Yeah.
I was happy to hear that. I mean, it always felt ironic, you know, because they had no idea of the connection there.
I think your note choices when you improvise are clearly come from a different place. Mm-hmm. But it's the actual sound. Mm-hmm. It's the sound of the notes, and that seems how can that be? Because I've heard. I mean, I've heard good cover bands. You know, good sax players, great saxophone play, you know, the solo from Jungle Land, or, you know, and they sound fine, they know, but they don't have that fat body, that particular sound. So how does that,
the thing that Clarence gave me early on was a direction in terms of like letting your soul speak, you know, like letting it come from your, like the depths of who you are. And, in that sense, like your approach isn't to make a specific sound. It's just coming out of you. So that is what it is.
So there's something ineffable about it. There's something that you can't really explain it then. It's just.
Yeah. I mean, like you cut your gut open and see what comes out, you know, that's what you got.
Yeah. One of the Marsalis brothers wrote that great essay about Clarence and about mm-hmm. how it's about the power of musical intention and mm-hmm. how it's, you know, because I think a lot of like jazz guys kind of like might have looked down on him and not really understood the power of what he did.
Yeah.
And but it's a whole different thing, as Marsalis wrote. It's just like it's about force and intention and it's like, and like your lips will hurt by the end of the evening, like if yeah. you try to do it. It's
about feeling more than it is about hearing.
Yeah. I assume you can play if you know you could play a bunch of like jazz notes and stuff if you wanted to, but you're sticking in the vein of Clarence and the E Street Band to the largest extent possible when you're up there.
Well, for me, I spend a lot of time researching like the intention behind the notes. Like when I say researching, I mean like listening to every single inflection that Clarence was putting in there so that I could understand what he wanted to say. Because I didn't want that to be lost. I wanted to be able to convey I was hoping to be able to convey this the same message, you know, and to find that voice. So, yeah, I mean, I hope that's what's in there.
So you recorded the album in like a whole bunch of studios. Why is that?
I think it's one of the great things that we have. You know, the realities of today that you can. That becomes easy to do.
And cities all over, I should mention, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's an aspect of, like, when you're recording a record, you're pulling in from that area as well. Like, there's a fingerprint of the geolocation that you're in and the community that you're around as well. So I think it's a great aspect of it to be able to, I don't know, let the album be diverse in that sense. But the majority of it was recorded in a town called Belleville, Ontario in Canada.
Why there?
Well, for one, I love the idea of like going somewhere to record. There's a theater there. It's called the Empire Theater. And we tracked it on stage there. Huh. It was purely for recording purposes. It was not a live experience, but it's got a great, great sound in the room. And the stage, it just has a great sound to it. So it turned out to be the perfect place to track the majority of the record.
That's interesting because you're also probably most comfortable on a stage, I bet. That probably
yeah, but it wasn't really set up to be, we weren't set up on stage as though we were performing a gotcha. Show, you know. But yeah, I mean, there's... A large dark room, you know, is not something that's typically you're going to find for recording purposes, but yeah, it was very appropriate.
I want to take you back to somewhere around is like you know, the Apollo Theater show. There's like a poster in the lobby here that we see every time we're up here. And that was your first show with the E Street Band. And there was that moment, I think it was Badlands when you stepped and again, I was there. I guess I've been just following around. I remember the moment, and it was a very powerful thing when we were in Badlands, and Bruce writes about it in his book as well, that the moment came for the sax solo, and you step up to the microphone and you played it. I mean, what was going through your head at that moment?
Yeah, I was very much in the moment. Yeah, trying my best not to be caught up in, emotionally, which was virtually impossible, I guess, to be honest. But, I don't know. I just wanted to, I wanted to represent, Clarence as best as I could. And I was just very aware of that. So I was fortunate enough to run into a small disaster in the moment where, it's the first time people were going to be hearing, my saxophone independently in this enormously important solo. And, I went and gave myself a little test. On the horn to just to make sure that it was working, and it did not work. It was not working, so I had to do an emergency switch. Literally, like seconds leading up to that saxophone solo. And if there's a YouTube video somewhere, you could probably see the intense panic on my face. But which also allowed me to completely like disconnect from any kind of overwhelming emotional sense.
Right,
you know, leading up to that first note, you know, it was just like we need to get this thing done, you know.
So, what's it like in general being, you know, the young guy in the E Street Band? How does that kind of affect everything? Just from, you know, being the designated guy to run around with Bruce to just socially, and how's that all kind of?
Well, it's not necessarily designated. I love doing that. You know, like it's I'm interacting with the audience is what I live for, you know, in that setting. So if that wasn't the case, I don't think that I would be asked to do that. But I don't know, just in general, as like I said, I've known these guys my whole life, and I don't know, I'm kind of an old soul in some ways, you know, and I often joke, like, the only backstage setting that's like more laid back and, like, you know, like less rock starish than the E Streets is mine. the only backstage environment you're gonna go to that's like more shocking in how in its conservatism is my backstage.
Well, I always say that you know, they call it backstage for a reason. Everything good happens on stage. Backstage for the most part is super boring, actually. But yeah.
It's not the 80s anymore, thank God. But
anyway. So this is Rolling Stone Music Now. We've been talking with Jake Clemons about life on E Street and about his great new solo album, Fear and Love. And that's our show for today. Be sure to download our podcast at rollingstone.com/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, and come listen to us next week on Volume at 1 p.m. on Friday. See you next week.